Okay, hello and welcome to Football Unfocused. Much sooner return than the previous couple of episodes where we've recorded an episode and made empty promises about immediate and regular podcasts and then sort of had 2 months off. I think this one's 3 weeks. So it's not quite the weekly return that we promised, but we're getting there at this rate. By sometime at the end of 2024, we'll be doing weekly, if not twice weekly, podcast.
So by then,
we'll have taken over the world by then, and we'll have sponsors falling over themselves to associate with this golden content. So we'll be having to do one a day. We'll be like Lineker, Richards and Shearer, but, you know, without the sort of wit or fame or insight. This is a podcast, to anyone who has not listened before, that is churned out now and again by two devoted and beloved school friends who are still in contact, albeit reluctantly, in their 40s. Mark and Matthew. I am Mark, and the other guy there is Matthew.
Hello.
Hello. Him saying hello, that'll probably be the best bit of content he comes up with today. I do the football talk. Considering this is a football podcast, you know,
Hit record.
He hits record. Matt hits record, and he does set up the recording session. So that's his contribution. The football side, you might notice if you've not listened before, he's not necessarily that engaged with / keen on. You know, the obvious question is, why is he co-hosting a football podcast? And we'll never know. We will never know. But what I do is to get under the skin of what makes him tick as this mysterious, uninterested in football human being in the Derbyshire region, is I ask him probing questions about him, himself and his psyche and his habits and his preferences, to really let you know what you're listening to, what you're investing in your time into. So I have questions, as usual, some really top quality questions that I shall henceforth ask Matthew. Matthew,
Mark,
would you rather? Hello. Hello. Would you rather be a slug or a worm?
What's that like? A shit face weasel, weasel face shit. Shit face weasel. I can't remember which one he chooses.
He chooses a weasel face shit, doesn't he? I think. Yeah. Would you rather have a face like a shit or a weasel? Weasel, probably. Yeah.
I think a slug, I'd rather be.
You'd rather be a slug than a worm. Why?
I think they sort of more fresh air, and they seem a bit more precocious, sort of a bit more worldly, or just a bit, or a bit.
They're well read, aren't they? They are well read.
Not well read, but just sort of street smarts. That's what I mean. It feels like they're
slugs are street smart.
Well, it feels just because they're so they're everywhere. That when they get somewhere, they really bed down. Whereas worms, I mean, they feel like.
So hold on. Getting back to your love of slugs before we get to your hatred of worms.
I don't. The slugs. I like worms.
It's the fact that they get somewhere and sort of colonize it that you like. You like.
Well, it's just that they're good at just looking after their own.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, so I'm gleaning from this that you're a big fan of sort of imperialism and empire and Brexit, which I already knew. Good. And worms, sorry, you just, you know.
Oh, they just
worms
like,
enrich the soil and they, they dig around. They only come up when they sort of, what was it, they feel the sunlight or whatever. No, they don't come up to get eaten, they hide.
They feel like, those sort of do-gooders, and they're,
slugs are badass, aren't they?
Well, they're, yeah.
They don't listen to the woke brigade, do they? The slugs.
No, exactly. They would never.
What about, most people quite like worms, though, whereas I'd say
I like worms.
This person despises slugs.
Yeah, I like worms.
But you'd rather be a slug.
Yeah.
But slugs, worms don't get hunted in the same way the slugs. You know, people put down pellets and chuck salt on slugs, don't they? So, like,
yeah.
Would you fear that if you were a slug?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is grim. Being salted to death.
Yeah, good.
Ricky
Gervais once asked Carl Pilkington when they used to do podcasts about 20 years ago, like, what would you do if you were a slug? He said, I'd chuck myself in the salt pot. finish himself off. Oh, dear. But you're more ambitious than Carl Pilkington. He would see being a slug as like a... That's the time when I just end it all, whereas you're just like, oh, no, new lease of life, off I go.
Yeah.
Let's find a nice spot in the park and get a load of other slugs down here. Yeah. Good. Matthew, you're the sort of person who likes, going to a coffee shop, don't you? You like a coffee. There's no running away from that. But if you're going to get, and I know that your Prudence may as well be your middle name, but if you're going to get a snack, a coffee shop-based snack alongside your beverage, what are you going for? What excites you? What do you see on the shelf that would really make you spend that extra, depending on where you are in the country, maybe £2.50, maybe £7?
I don't know. I'm slightly disappointed with the selection of vegan snacks within coffee shops. I don't feel they're quite as exciting as...
What about the burgeoning vegan scene in Glossop? Is it not? Well, famous.
Yeah, I mean, it's growing, but what I would like is like a vegan croissant that I could dip in my mocha that would be nice. Do you not know?
That's disgusting.
But it's quite French.
Dipping a croissant in a mocha.
Yeah, that's like that's what they do in France.
Do they? I just see them. I mean, I see people eating croissants, not just in France, but never seen them dip it in their coffee.
They all do it. They all do that.
They all do it, don't they? Yeah, Pierre and Jacques and all the lads. Yeah, they all do it.
Maybe a big American style cookie, that would also be nice.
How's that vegan?
Well, again, they often aren't. So that's what I would choose.
If you weren't vegan, and in the old days when you weren't vegan or when you were just vegetarian, which was, I think from memory, about 6 weeks ago. But what would you go for then? Is it the croissant that's getting you there? Or a cookie?
It probably would be the cookie, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What about if you go further down the sort of cookie road, would you like something like a rocky road? Do you like a slab or tray bake?
So I think the next down would be slices of cakes.
Yeah, like, as in like, you know, someone's baked a big cake and like, you know, with 12 slices. What cake are you going for?
I'm just trying to, maybe a coffee cake.
Yes.
That would be nice.
There's nothing funny about that, Matthew. It's very nice.
No, I know.
In water or just coffee?
Coffee and walnut, yeah, that'd be nice.
Yeah, lovely. Am I making you hungry, Matthew?
Oh, I know. Oh. See if you can hear me salivating down here.
I can, yeah. Oh, God, I can see it. It's disgusting. Matthew, final question. We just want to know about your habits, what you're into. What are you currently enjoying on the telly?
We watched Maestro with Bradley Cooper recently. Yeah,
that's a film.
It's a film. He's playing Leonard Bernstein.
I know.
Composer. That was really good. It was really, really good.
Was it?
And
I think a non-Jewish man has been chosen to play a quintessentially Jewish part.
And then
would that
be fine
if it was, you know, like a, you know, an Asian man or a black man?
Yeah. No. I think I agree. Because there was, who was that English actor who recently played the Israeli prime minister during it was a film about the 9-day war or the 7-day war or something like that I can't remember her name, but she's obviously not Jewish, and similar criticism. And you think they're cotton on to that, and you think, well, you've got to stop doing this, yeah, like, because there's plenty of plenty of fantastic actors who are do have a Jewish heritage. It's all part of
David Baddiel's Jews don't count argument, isn't it?
I need to read his book.
Yeah, it's very good. He made an accompanying document. If you can't be able to read the book, he did like an hour Channel 4 documentary, which basically sums up the key arguments, and it's quite compelling.
Yeah.
He has a couple of famous Jewish show business interviewees on there, David Schwimmer being one of them, and Sarah Silverman, and they both talk about how, you know, that non-Jewish actors always get Jewish roles, and how they're sort of the tide has turned against that sort of cultural appropriation,
kind
of other underrepresented groups, but not with Jews. It's fine for a non-Jewish person to play a Jew.
Yeah, no, I think they will stop doing that, because it does seem self.
Good film though.
Good film. And I was
just on the telly though. Not telly. That's a film you've watched on telly.
Broad City. That's quite. We've rediscovered that quite recently. Yeah, it's like it's on now. You've got Sky, don't you? You'd be able to get it. Yeah, watch it. It's like a good version of Sex in the City.
All right.
Honestly, you should watch it. You might like it. I know. Okay. I know. I recommended once Bo Burnham, and you absolutely thought it was ridiculous.
Well, you recommended someone who had. I mean, I could not despise musicals more if I tried.
Yeah.
Absolutely, fundamentally despise them. And
I didn't know you sent me
a musical comedy to watch, and I got 5 minutes in ago, and I remember messaging you saying, "Does he sing all the way through?"
Yeah.
And you were like, "Oh yeah." I was like, "He didn't mention that bit."
But yeah, Broad City. It's very good. Watch that.
Okay. I'd say watch Slow Horses on Apple TV if you get the chance. Gary Oldman. And a bunch of other brilliant actors as well, but he's like the lead. The idea is they're basically sort of discarded substandard MI5 agents who work in this sort of shitty sub office called Slough House, even though it's still in London. It's called Slough House because even though it's only 3 miles from the main MI5 office in Westminster, it they're so poorly connected to the rest of MI5, it might as well be in Slough. And it's fucking brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
Oh, great. I'll check that out.
Yeah, check that out. Yeah, Slow Horses. Anyway, football. Matthew, watched a lot of football in the 3 weeks since we last recorded an episode.
There's two things that I've noted. The first is about, just so many headlines about blue cards.
Oh yeah. Oh god. Yeah.
We don't have to talk about that. But no, that's one thing.
I suppose it is an indication of just how little the people making decisions about the game, you know, where their priorities are, actually understand about the problems that need addressing. That is something that they would even consider at the moment. When the implementation of VAR is still such a shambles, and they want to throw in another sort of, you know, untried variable, but the whole point is they want to trial it, don't they?
Go on.
What's the other one?
Well, this was something I forgot to mention the last time we recorded.
Brilliant. So we're talking about something that happened in
January. It's kind of a long-running story, but it kind of crossed over into slight politics and values, which was that's where I was in. But it's about Jordan Henderson and his kind of move and the trials and tribulations of what he went through or what he decided to do.
For the sake of, 4 months in Saudi Arabia, and then he sort of had to come back with his tail between his
legs. Yeah, that was and I saw I think I mentioned I was up in the Lake District recently for Joe's birthday. We went to see Dear England.
Ah, the play.
The play.
The Gareth Southgate play. Yeah, I was in London. I didn't know they'd taken it around the country.
Well, you can go into a cinema and watch it.
Oh, you watched it in a cinema.
Yeah. Off the play. them in London. Yeah.
It was. Is it live stream or like a recording?
No, it wasn't live stream.
That's brilliant.
It was fantastic. It was so good.
Apparently, right wing people really hate it. Because it's, you know, they call it, it's just virtue signaling.
Woke
nonsense.
Yeah. It's just sort of, it's all that sort of.
Because isn't it based on, he wrote that letter, didn't he? To sort of like appeal.
Well, is that true? Like, so he wrote that
letter.
Yeah,
he did. Yeah,
that's what he did. Just the whole how he changed the mentality of the team, how. You know, it was lots and lots about the psychology of what he tried to do.
Yeah.
A totally different tack in terms of he tried to take the pressure off them. He sort of went into the World Cup sort of saying, look, we're not going to win this, to take the pressure off. And then he really kind of got them speaking to each other and, you know, like...
Yes.
Loads and loads. It was really good, really interesting.
Yeah, do you know what? I don't want to... Because obviously we talk more about international stuff when it comes to like the big tournaments or international breaks. But when I hear people, like, particularly when I've been very critical of Gareth Southgate, and I can appreciate that it is at times frustrating because it feels like he's not necessarily getting the most out of a generation of England players that is of almost unprecedented levels of quality and depth. And it does, often you're watching and you think you're playing a little bit with a handbrake on. But I'll say two things. Firstly, if you've just watched any football, basically, in your life, teams that win tournaments tend to play that way. It's very, very rare. In fact, I can't think of a time when the team that are just completely open and all out attacking and incredible to watch have ended up winning the tournament. It just doesn't happen. Like, you look at how Brazil, famous for their open style, but just never play like that anymore. And when they've won the World Cup in my life, 94 and 2002, they've been, you know, very pragmatic teams with incredible flair players. But you just go, you know, there's a lot of people mythologize and misremember. But if you go back and watch the performances of those teams in those tournaments, they were functional and winning games through moments of brilliance or a bit of brilliant teamwork by their sort of best players, you know, Ronaldo and Rivaldo and Ronaldinho and such, like, you know, Romario, Bebeto. So I'd say that kind of explains to some extent Southgate's approach. And he's done a huge amount of research on like data and stuff as well, and looking at previous tournaments, Euros. And so he's, you know, he's a smart guy. So, and the team around him. So, and I'd say on the other side, people forget as well what he inherited when he came along. England were an absolute shambles. They'd just been knocked out of Euro 2016 by Iceland. And for years, including the full decade of the supposed golden generation, when England had all these world-leading stars. They went at one time, they had Steven Gerrard, Frank Lampard, Paul Scholes, Wayne Rooney, David Beckham, and Sol Campbell, Rio Ferdinand, John Terry, all in the same squad. I mean, Ashley Cole, unbelievable footballers at sort of club level, but they were absolutely awful to watch and a bag of shit. And now you hear the truth. They were all denying it at the time. You hear the truth now they've all retired. And so the team spirit was awful. They hated going to international duty. They would sit on different tables, or their club rivalries were having an impact on how they interacted with each other. Southgate has killed all of that. He's created a genuine club mentality. I think a big part of it is he coached the younger players and the under-21s previously, and has been responsible for bringing a lot of them into the squad. So they're already very comfortable with his style and they trust him. He has an incredible relationship with players whereby, you know, he's so loyal. In fact, you know, again, one of the criticisms is he's too loyal. People always throw in the Harry Maguire example that he picks him even if he's not, and you know, Calvin Phillips, even if they're not playing club football, they'll still get picked. But, and another thing, the relationship between those players and the press, which was always part of the sort of mix of stuff that made England supposedly such an impossible thing to play for, he's completely transformed that. And they're now encouraged not to be suspicious of the press. They're just open. They'll do. They'll show more of their personalities. And they,
all that stuff.
The Euros this summer.
Yeah, but so all that stuff you mentioned, they touch upon it. It's really interesting. Really good.
Good. Well, fair play. If only you could. rather than going to watch a play about football, just watch some football being played. Yeah. You've got the right words, but they're just in the wrong order. I mean, it was interesting, wasn't it? Based on, you know, and I won't go on about this now because it's now 3 weeks old, but we recorded on a Thursday 3 weeks ago, and that was almost immediately out of date because the very next day, Jurgen Klopp, the greatest Liverpool manager in my match attending life, announced he'd be leaving at the end of the season, and that was such a massive story for a week or so. And that's as these things do, that sort of died down now, and obviously life goes on, and you've got to get through the rest of the season, and it's going to be very interesting to see who ends up getting that job. Everyone seems to think it'll be Xabi Alonso, but regardless of who it is. There are not many clubs who have a manager for that long and who has that level of impact over a club that don't then go through a period of decline. And I think you have to be realistic about that. And what you have to do is hope that the extent of the decline, you have to either trust or not the way that that particular club is being run to sort of predict, decide, whatever, whether that decline is likely to be sort of fundamental or just a bit of a bump in the road, and then they're ready to sort of go again. Because a news story has broken today, for example, and this was data that is produced, I think, on an annual basis by, let me just actually look up, I can't remember who, it's the European Club Finance and Investment Landscape Report, right, which comes out once a year. Which is sanctioned by UEFA, right? So this is official stuff. The Manchester United team to the end of 2023, so that's what, only about 6 weeks ago, is in the history of football the most expensive squad of players ever assembled, ever, right? So everyone goes on about the money in Saudi Arabia, they're going on about the money spent by Manchester City and PSG and stuff, and those sort of, I'm not saying they're wrong to do this, but a lot of people are quite snooty about the sort of new money types and people getting their money from nation states and all that stuff. But in that landscape, when people obsess and sort of angle all their criticism at the clubs that are getting their money from undemocratic nation states with poor human rights records, despite all of that, and limitless amounts of money as well, their squad, which has a combined cost of, wait for it, £1.42 billion. Right, that's euros. So that's £1.2 billion. Right? £1.2 billion. And that was to finish, to sort of scrape into the top four, to get knocked out of the Champions League before Christmas. And around the time these figures were collated, towards the end of 2023, I think they'd just lost their ninth league game of the season with less than half of it completed at that stage. So all I'm saying, and some of the highlights include £82 million for Antony, a non-scoring wide attacking midfielder with, shall we say, a questionable future in terms of the likelihood he's going to be appearing at some point in a court of law. £80 million on Harry Maguire, you tell me about that one. £73 million on Jadon Sancho, who, what, a couple of years later has already been loaned back to the club that they gave £73 million to buy him from in the first place. And £70 million on Casemiro, who is one of the greatest defensive midfielders in the history of world, certainly world football in the 21st century, but to spend £70 million on a player who was already 29 and achieved more than any player could possibly hope to do in the lifetime, you've got to think, why are the biggest club in the world, Real Madrid, prepared to let him go? And what are the motives of this guy joining us? And I think there's been flashes of times when he's been absolutely brilliant. But I think on the whole, you know, but yeah, there's been quite a few injuries, quite a few, you know, sort of suspensions, and but no break in the remuneration. So yeah, interesting, yeah. But and bear in mind that is despite the fact that Chelsea,
you're in the top five.
So three other squads, Manchester City, Chelsea, and Real Madrid, they all cost more than 1 billion. Their squads are all over the £1 billion mark. And bear in mind at Chelsea's as well, they're going to likely be at the top of it next season because Chelsea's figures only, for some reason, it must be to do with the way individual clubs publish their accounting, only go up to June 2022. Since then, they've spent 850 million from the summer of that was just from the summer of that year and August 2023. I'm not included, so yeah, so good luck with that. And you know, I mean, Chelsea at the moment appear to be having a little bit of a resurgence, but then the amount of times this season, it looks like they're doing all right for a couple of games. I mean, we played them a couple of weeks ago, it was our first home league game after Jurgen announced he was going, and we absolutely mullered them. I mean, it was 4-1, 10-1 wouldn't even, you know, they should have had a penalty, but it wouldn't have made any difference. Like, honestly, 10-1 would not have mattered. They were an absolute embarrassment. But, you know, they're playing us in the League Cup final in a couple of weeks' time, so they'll probably, you know, the way football works, they'll probably beat us in that. But I guess the reason that all of this is relevant is that, you know, so many, when you hear football fans like sort of whinging and stuff and, you know, wishing that, you know, being often speaking quite sort of jealously about other clubs and their unlimited funds and stuff, it just demonstrates that even if you have got some of the deepest pockets and you do invest in players to the extent that other clubs could only dream of, it doesn't guarantee you any sort of success, because, you know, even Manchester City weren't winning league title every season. They were spending their level of money, but they'd won two league titles since the money came in that sort of 10 years or so. And then Pep Guardiola comes along and they won, what, five league titles in 6 years. Without having the right team of people in charge, you can spend all the money in the world, it won't make any bloody difference. That's quite interesting, I guess. Today is a relatively interesting story. Today's Thursday the 15th of February, and there's a story that appears to be breaking that is sort of reminiscent of like old school sort of Politburo stuff, where the 76-year-old Roy Hodgson, who has been under great pressure in recent weeks because Crystal Palace have been in like absolutely shocking form, sort of, you know, tanking, falling down the table. I think they're only 5 points clear of the relegation zone. And there's been a lot of talk that poor old Roy would lose his job. Today, suddenly there's this flurry of activity around lunchtime that, oh, he's getting fired. And everyone's reporting, yeah, he's about to be fired. He hasn't officially been fired yet. And that they've actually, Palace have agreed a contract with the replacement, Oliver Glasner, who was the Eintracht Frankfurt manager who won the Europa League against Rangers in the final a couple of years ago, beat West Ham in the semi-final. So that's all sort of done. But there's now this weird scenario where Roy Hodgson was supposed to, because ahead of the Saturday and Sunday games, the managers typically do their press conference on either a Thursday or Friday afternoon. Mm. And Roy Hodgson didn't appear to the press conference today because he was, quote, taken ill at training. And because of this, there's now been a complete, like, the story has sort of completely gone dead. And there's this like air of mystery around whether, like, what is it? Is this, quote, taken ill thing a genuine thing that couldn't have come at a worse time for the club into, oh God, we were going to fire the guy. Now he's like, genuinely, what the fuck do we do? Or is it like a smoke screen to then excuse them, sort of like bidding him off and try and say, oh no, he wasn't fired, but he's actually had to have a break because, you know, he's unwell or whatever. Or, I mean, like in the after the death of Brezhnev, there was those two really old fellas, Andropov and another fellow, who were very briefly leaders of the Soviet Union before sort of quietly being pushed off their perches, and then Gorbachev came along. And it kind of reminds me of that, this sort of like this bizarre thing where you've got like a sort of decaying institution with like an ancient guy at the helm, and they're just sort of being like shuffled off. And you know that stuff's going on behind the scenes, but you can't quite work out what and who's pulling the strings. It's a bizarre situation. But you'd think that poor old Roy, after all these years in the game, would deserve maybe a little bit more dignity than that. But I just hope he's all right.
Well, he says he's stable in hospital. Apparently, that's what BBC are reporting at the moment.
So the BBC are now saying he has been taken to hospital.
He's
surely you can't
stable in
them.
Hospital. You can't what? Right?
That's what, surely you can't then fire the man. If the health thing... I mean, imagine if it's a power play on Hodgson's behalf and he's like, well, they're going to fire me. Right. Steve, right, I'm going to fall now, right? Crowd around me, call an ambulance. Maybe he's just like thinking, oh, they can't fire me. They won't fire me if they think I've collapsed.
I'm sick.
Yeah.
And then but the main headline on the BBC is... Mbappe tells PSG intends to.
Yeah, I saw that. I mean, God,
yeah, chat out.
Wow, the amount of times that has been a story in the last 4 or 5 years. Every year around this time, you come in, you're starting to get on the verge of spring, and Kylian Mbappe is going to be definitely joining Real Madrid in the summer, and then, you know, then it's this. I mean, I think it's got to a stage now where people just don't really give a shit anymore. It's like, you either join Real Madrid or sign your new massive contract at PSG, but just like, God, just shut up about it. Like, because it's literally the same story every bloody year. It's tiresome, really. I mean, he's an unbelievable footballer, and obviously anyone would want to sign him, but I think it's clear that at some point he's going to play for Real Madrid. It's just a matter of when.
Mm.
Did you watch... I don't know why I'm asking this.
Did
you watch any of the AFCON, the African Cup of Nations? Did you see
No, that? But I heard the host obviously lost their manager. They sacked their manager halfway through. And then they had a massive
tournament.
They were saying that actually managers don't, on average, don't actually make huge amounts of difference to... the performance of teams. There's only an exceptional couple. So this was on a Radio 4 BBC, and they were talking about it, and he was saying there's a couple of exceptions, like Ferguson and Jurgen Klopp, but they don't make huge amounts.
I'd imagine what they're referring to there. I think about a month or so ago there was a piece of research published, and it, bear in mind this, you know, they haven't just plucked this research out of the fucking sky. Like this is stuff that they're looking statistically at facts over a long, long period of time. And it's about the impact of changing managers, a manager coming in, and then the difference between that manager, their impact on the club and the performance of the team compared to like the previous manager. And I think that they found that on average across all hirings and firings in I don't know whether it was just British football or whether they've done it across like the big European leagues, but on average a positive appointment of a manager only makes a 6-point per season difference to a club. So that's why they paid the big bucks. That probably is about right, and that, I suppose that's why the very best elite managers are so good at what they do. Because there are some that, I mean, everyone with Pep Guardiola, people always throw the thing at him. Oh, would he be able to manage if he didn't have the money? You know, he's only ever managed where his club have been like had the biggest budget and the best players, and they love to undermine the Barcelona achievement with the fact that he had Messi almost like having Messi was like having a cheat card, and you know, but completely ignoring the fact that around Messi he assembled the greatest club side ever to exist, and they are the greatest club side. That Barcelona team of that 3 or 4 year period, I think I've said it before in this podcast, it's not exactly a contentious point, because I think a lot of people who can, you know, understand the game in any way, shape or form would agree that football's never been that good before in terms of the way they played that. And you know, and also I think in Spain, Real Madrid consistently spend a lot more than Barcelona anyway. Certainly now that Barcelona are a shill of a club owned by Goldman Sachs, and you know, everything's going wrong for them. AFCON. Yeah. So I mean, I watched a reasonable amount of it, and there were some last few AFCONs. I found them on the whole really quite turgid and difficult to watch. I felt that there's been a trend of a move towards much more negative, sort of defensive, risk-free football and intense physicality. But there were some mad games in this one. There was some really, really good stuff. And the final itself was a good match. And it was great that Sebastian Haller, who had to take time out of the game a couple of years ago for having testicular cancer. It's a real, like, I love it when football produces these stories, when a genuine, feel good comeback story of he then gets the winner, the late winner for his country, and wins, on home turf as well. I did have to laugh at the end when I was watching the trophy celebration, though. The president of Ivory Coast was, talk about conforming to every stereotype of a sort of egotistical, all-powerful African leader, where he was making it all about him. So he was loitering around the trophy. Like, it looked, look it up. This is all be online. Like, it looked like he was intent on making sure that the captain couldn't get anywhere near it. He wanted it for himself. And then he was sort of him, and they did that thing now where they always do, where rather than the sort of, you know, captain going up first or last and just lifting the trophy, they sort of get everyone to go and collect, get their medals. They all go stand on the podium, and then the captain collects the trophy and then walks over to his team, and, you know, it's for photo reasons, isn't it? And then he goes and stands at the front, lifts the trophy. And the president of Ivory Coast was, or Cote d'Ivoire, as we should say, was sort of shadowing him the whole time and sort of standing in front of him and wasn't letting go of the trophy. And I was watching this thinking, he's going to fucking lift it. The president's going to fucking lift the trophy. Like, what the fuck? And at the last minute, Max Gradle, who used to play for the Leeds United, I wouldn't go as far as say he wrestled it away from him, but there, you can see there's a moment where he relatively firmly sort of grabs it and lifts it before the, but even then the president is then, I think maybe he got caught slightly unaware that the trophy had been lifted, and he was looking to grab it. And I was watching it on my phone while I was getting ready for bed, sort of cleaning my teeth or something. And the next time I looked at my phone a minute later, none of the players had the trophy. It was him and his delegation who were walking around the pitch with the trophy. Yeah, incredible. I mean, of course the players will have had it at various points, but all I'm saying is, like, can you imagine, like, England winning the Euros this summer?
Boris Johnson wandering around.
No, Rishi Sunak and some of the members of the cabinet just going, like, just refusing, like, just loitering around the trophy. So, I mean, there'd be a bloody riot for a start. But, oh, man, it's just, incredible, really. Great. And I suppose the only last thing we should really touch upon is I think I spoke a couple of weeks ago about, like, the title race and how that was shaping up. And in the time since we've recorded the last podcast, Arsenal have given Liverpool a good seeing to, and given West Ham then their biggest home defeat since the early 1960s, when they lost 8-2 to Blackburn Rovers. And not long before that, they had a really good win at Forest as well. And then I think they someone else at the Emirates. So they're on a right old run of form. And you have to say, I mean, I still, you know, I'd like, I, obviously this season I'd like Liverpool to win the league, but I'm always quite sanguine about these things and, you know, and honest, and I'll say you have to say statistically and based on, you know, resources and you know, history that Manchester City are likely to do it. But if Liverpool were not to win the league, I would much rather it was Arsenal than Manchester City, if only for the, you know, the variety. And the way they're going at the moment, you've got to say, wow, like, because they've got all of the quality that they had last season, with, like, obviously Declan Rice thrown into the mix, who's, you know, made a big difference to the made sort of midfield even better. And, you know, if they are able to utilize the knowledge of how close they got last season and kind of what it was that made them fall slightly short. Although I don't like using terms like falling short when you're in a title race against Man City, because when you're in a title race against Man City, normal rules don't apply. It's not you that blows it. It's because you're up against a freakishly good opponent. And like you have to go to levels that you would have never had to go to before in order to overcome them. And I say that about, that times Liverpool sort of came second to them, but with points totals that would have won the league in any other season in history. And it was, you know, not that dissimilar, not quite to that level, but not that dissimilar last season for Arsenal. They had an amazing season and, you know, very nobly sort of fell a little bit short. So, yeah, at the moment, they look absolutely unbelievable. It's whether they're able to maintain it, I suppose. And at some point, they'll be playing Manchester City at City. So I really think that the last 3 months of this season are going to be really quite captivating. And there's going to be some amazing games. And it could actually be a proper three-way title race. But equally, the way that football works, 2 weeks down the line, if Liverpool and Arsenal, you know, they only take one slip up, City win a game in hand, then all of a sudden they're motoring away. So we shall see. But anyway, that was great to be back again for another episode of Football Unfocused. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you, Mark.
And thank you, everyone out there, for listening. I mean, fuck knows why you do, but if you have, thank you, especially if you stuck with us to the end. We'll aim to be back maybe as early as next week. Who the fuck knows? And until then, take care and goodbye.